Campus FM presents a talk in the Work in Progress seminar series entitled Rubbish Politics, Political Motivation and the Reluctance to Recycle in Maltese Environmental Behavior. This talk is delivered by Ms. Mari Briguglio.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Good evening, radio audience. Welcome back to the Work in Progress seminars. We meet tonight on a strange evening when the Scirocco has obscured visibility outside, but I'm glad that people had the courage to get themselves together and come to this evening's venue. Tonight we welcome Mari Briguglio. Mari is a lecturer in economics and social marketing at the University of Malta. She has her Bachelor of Commerce and BA Honours degree in economics from the University of Malta. She has her Master's degree with distinction from the University College London in environmental economics, and now she is pursuing research on a PhD in behavioral economics at the University of Stirling. And I think tonight, some of what she says and some of the arguments she gives us is going to be based upon the research and the data she is collecting for her PhD in behavioral economics. I asked Mari for a title, and she gave me a very academic title, The Regional Determinants of Recycling Behavior. And then I wrote to her and said, please give me a much sexier title, and she brilliantly and immediately came up with the sexy title for tonight's seminar. It is Rubbish Politics, and the subtitle is Political Motivation and the Reluctance to Recycle in Maltese Environmental Behavior. So welcome, Mari.
Thank you very much, Paul. Thank you all for being here in such large numbers. I'll tell you first a bit about the research area and the rationale for my studying in this area, and then I'll go into the findings of the first paper and then a sneak preview of the second paper in this field. So basically, in terms of area, what I'm looking at is the determinants of voluntary pro-environmental behavior. In other words, what makes people do nice things for the environment voluntarily. And I'm focusing on recycling, and as I'm focusing on voluntary recycling, then I'm looking mainly at things that are related to communication rather than fiscal instruments or regulation. By way of motivating this work, we know that landfills are still a major challenge in EU countries, and their continued growth is also a challenge for Malta. Recycling being one way to avoid continued dependence on landfill. We also know that communication is pervasive. We do try to communicate with people to get them to do the right thing, but it is costly and evidently often based on inspiration rather than scientific analysis of what makes people listen or move or change behavior. Voluntary behavior in the environmental field has the promise of being an unexplored policy tool. So the fact that we might not be doing it so right is bad for the present, but really good for the future, because it means that there is scope to do it better. Because we're dealing with recycling, which is an economic decision in the environmental field, we're dealing with communication and voluntary measures. You could say that this study falls academically in the field of behavioral environmental economics. Okay, so here's my first paper, which is in an advanced stage. In fact, we're looking to send it to publication together with my supervisors now. It's called Curbside Enthusiasm, the Determinants of Voluntary Waste Separation in Malta. Now, the people here from WasteServe will recognize these bags in the picture. They're the gray bags that people use to recycle. So this is what got me started on the PhD in the first place. Imagine this scenario. So daily curbside collection of mixed municipal solid waste was carried out for free. In other words, people could throw away as much rubbish as they want, as often as they want, and not pay anything. Now introduce a voluntary scheme in which separated waste is collected at a fee on a weekly basis, which means that people were required to give more space to waste storage, more effort and time to cleaning and separating the waste, and to boot, pay money for the bags. Recall that this was at a time when most people were using free retail plastic bags to remove their rubbish, so they weren't even necessarily paying for black bags. Everything in my training as an economist said, nobody's going to take this up. Okay? Why would people pay more to make more effort, to store their waste, be bundled with it, be saddled with it for a week, when they could alternatively not make any effort at all and dump all their stuff in a bag and take it out and it's picked up on a daily basis? This was not the behavior that anyone would expect of a rational economic man, of Homo economicus. Homo economicus would say, no way, there's no way I'm going to do it. And yet the outcome was that this national curbside recycling scheme actually did take off. And it did so at different rates in different localities. And that's what recycling kilograms looked like in the first 1.5 years of this scheme. It's 1.5 years because lots of things changed afterwards, but this gives a really good glimpse of the first effectively 86 weeks of recycling in Malta. And you can see that it goes from zero to a reasonable amount of kilograms with fluctuations. Those mainly reflect feast days and, you know, missed collection rates. But the trend is one of increase. So, of course, if we study this, if we get to grips with what's going on here, what we have is the possibility to empirically analyze what makes an intervention effective, despite the odds. We also have a documented case study of cooperation in a social dilemma. It's a social dilemma because it's good for everybody, but not good for the individual, and hence the dilemma. So it's good for everybody if everybody does it, but not good for the individual. And yet people did it. It's a case study in behavioral environmental economics and contributes to the literature. It's an issue with high stakes. This is an expensive policy area. And if we discover that we've tapped a voluntary approach, then we can use it elsewhere. It's also a potential to explore whether all our emphasis at making policy targeted at the rational, egoistic Homo economicus is misdirected. Maybe we do have altruistic people in our midst. Maybe we should tap that as a motivation. Maybe policy which assumes that everybody is out to make a buck or to save money is having unintended harmful side effects of actually turning people into people who are just thinking of their selfish motives. So, in effect, it could be, if we document what's going on, a good contribution to policy as well. Just a quick look at the literature. There is such a field called behavioral environmental economics, which is looking precisely at this kind of phenomenon. Could we be looking at policy which taps the cooperator in us, which actually harnesses this desire to do good? And those are the main authors, or some of the protagonists in the field. We've got Zotberg and Chogren and Taylor. There's also, as I was to discover when I actually embarked on this research, quite a lot of modeling going on to actually understand what makes households recycle. So I certainly wasn't starting on fresh grounds. And those models do include moral motives and social motives. So there was a lot for me to get started with. Halvorsen, Nyberg, and Rege, these are the type of people who look at this type of motivation. And there is a wealth of empirical studies on recycling, which is good because it meant that I had a lot to look at, but bad because it meant that the field is quite saturated. In fact, there's even an OECD review of what makes recycling happen, the 2008 review, and plenty of field studies. It was 30 at the point that I had reviewed in detail at the point where I wrote this presentation, but it just increases exponentially the more I find of these studies. Okay, so summarizing the literature, what does the literature say about what would make a household recycle in this way? Very simply, narrow self-interest does play a part, so if you make it easy for people to recycle, or easier than to dump rubbish, they will recycle. There's also moral and social motives. People do it to feel good. People do it to be like other people. There's also non-cognitive motives, like people do it out of habit. So beyond a certain amount of actually doing it, you don't think about it anymore. Interventions play a big role in why people do recycle. So anything that's pecuniary, so that makes it more expensive or cheaper, does play a role. Convenience, major issue in recycling, and communication. Very dubious results in the case studies, whether communication has actually made a difference or not. And then there's literature which looks at who recycles. What is the profile of the recycler? So, for example, do the educated recycle more? Do the elderly recycle more? Do women recycle more? And of course, the results are mixed because these demographics embody a lot of other motives, right? So if education, for example, could embody increased awareness, but also more expensive time. And so the highly educated might have mixed motives whether to recycle more or less. Their time is more expensive, but they're more aware, and so forth. What I then did was, on the basis of models which are already available and of my contribution focus, which was to see the moral motive primarily, I devised a model which I will not go into, but suffice it to say that is underpinned by the idea, don't look at that because it's too much, the key idea is, here is a household. It wants to recycle because it's going to get some moral good feeling out of doing it. It wants to recycle if it compares itself to others that it sees are recycling. And it wants to recycle because it wants to do good for the environment. Okay? So all of these are propelling it to do it. But what's constraining it from doing it is its time, right? And the expense of dedicating time, its space that it could use for other things in the house, and also the price of the recycling bags. Okay, so because in Malta we had this exceptional circumstance where it was more expensive temporarily to recycle, then price could be looked at as a constraint rather than a motive. Okay, so once we simplify that model for estimation, going straight to this, this is the linear function which was estimated, and I'm going to explain that very simply by saying that the kilograms of separated waste observed every week are a function of the intervention that took place in that week in that particular locality, the constraints which households in a particular locality faced. So the more constrained households are, the less they will recycle, and other controls, as well as a time trend to capture learning, observation, habit, etc. Let me come down to a level which is more easy to understand, because we're going to make the hypothesis of what we're going to test, okay? So our expectation is that in those localities where certain conditions hold, we will observe more recycling. So the hypothesis is that recycling peaks in those localities where there's government communication, so where there's high PR, frequency of collection, making it more convenient. So in those localities where they collect it twice a week, I would expect to see more recycling per capita. And where there's lower fees. Now, we know that the fees weren't lower in any locality, but we also know that for the first 13 weeks, at least, local councils gave bags away for free. So I would expect that to have a positive influence, okay? Also, in those localities where people have lower opportunity cost of time, so where there's fewer graduates is what I presumed, bigger space, so lower population density, and lower income problems, and where there's stronger moral and normative preferences. So where their desire to conform or to do good could be higher. And there's habit over time. These are the null hypotheses. What data did I have to prove or disprove these null hypotheses? So let me just recap to make it simple, okay? I'm very simply saying, how do we explain why certain localities recycled more than others and why certain weeks saw peaks in recycling more than others? And my model tries to explain this with reference to convenience, intervention, and the type of profile of the population in that locality. The context from which I'm drawing the data is Malta, which you all know has high population density in 68 localities, 2 inhabited islands, 2 political parties, and at that point, the lowest recycling in the EU. This was the scheme, which was called Recycling Tuesdays, whereby 3 streams of waste could be put in a grey bag at the curbside. The average price was something like 8 cents a bag. And I looked at 86 weeks, starting from March 2008. This map shows the take-up. Those cluster areas are the local councils, the built areas, okay? So although Malta split into 68 pieces, really and truly the locality is that cluster which you're seeing there. The darker the locality, the higher their recycling on average, okay? So everybody quickly looks at their locality to see if they're amongst the winning localities or not. Okay, and that's how much they recycled on average. So we're looking at 0.5 kilo or more per household per week, or less on average, okay? Where did I get the data to do all of this? I had recycling volumes by locality by week, which was actually collected by WasteServe, made available by MEPA to analyze this. I had intervention design, which I actually had to go to all 68 local councils to ask them the extent of promotion that they did in those weeks, the number of times per week that they collected, and so forth. And then I was lucky that in the same time that WasteServe rolled out with the local councils this scheme, the NSO decided to conduct an analysis across all localities of Malta of the socioeconomics of each locality. So I had poverty for localities, I had gender, I had age, I had, well, basically whatever you wanted of each locality. I also got information from the Tourism Authority, Department of Information for holidays and feasts. Anyway, in terms of collecting data, this was nothing short of a nightmare. But at the end, I had a panel of weeks and localities of data. This is what the data that I plugged into my model looked like. So I had kilos per capita of recycling waste, so on and so forth. Now, let's get to the politics bit. Why do I have vote as one of my variables? Well, my argument was this. How am I going to gauge the moral motive in different localities? In some studies, they look at how many people vote green as an indicator of environmental motivation. I didn't have that because the Green Party only contests local council elections in Malta in some localities. In some others, they have awareness indices of people in localities. I didn't have that either. But my hypothesis was that people who trust government, who have an efficacy belief in government, who vote for government, may actually recycle more. And so I used that as the moral motive. Now, In any model, you have the key variable which you're trying to determine and the control variables. Nothing in this model is novel except this moral motive, and that is my key question. Does this moral motive stimulate recycling? We know from other studies that price, recycling being more expensive, is bound to suppress recycling. Localities where there's a huge dense population is going to suppress recycling because they don't have so much space. Localities where there's a high amount of graduates, which means a higher cost of time, this might suppress recycling. In localities where there's a lot of tourists, there's likely to be less norm conformity, less homogeneity, this will suppress recycling. I knew that as time went by, we're going to observe an increase because of habit. So all of these, I had an a priori. I also had an a priori for moral, but this was the one that I was interested in testing. And so what came out of this? Well, these are the results, which you're obviously not going to be able to decipher, so I'm going to give you a shortcut to what I found. So I found that in those localities where the local council stated or gave me an indication that they were heavy on promotion, this had a positive effect on the observed recycling. In those localities where the frequency of collection of recycling waste was higher, this also had a positive effect on recycling. Whether or not they collected waste, the mixed waste, more frequently, had no effect on recycling. Probably there was both a positive and a negative impact cancelling out each other. On the one hand, it improves convenience and space for recycling. On the other hand, it makes it more tempting to just throw rubbish away if it's collected more frequently. Whenever there was a holiday in the day which coincided with recycling day, no surprises there, this suppressed the observed recycling. In those weeks when free bags were given out in the first 13 weeks, this had no effect on recycling. In the net, which means there might have been a positive effect that the bags were given out, but a negative effect because it was early start. So the first 13 weeks were likely to be handicapped by the fact that they were the first 13 weeks. Okay? So notice that this is a multiple regression, and so therefore what I'm doing is isolating the effect of each. Where the locality was characterized by poverty, that means that from the statistics of the NSO, there was a lot of households receiving assistance, okay? This suppressed recycling. So in poor localities, always set par, right? Always holding everything else constant. The poorer the locality, the less the recycling. Population density also suppresses recycling, an index of space. Graduates suppress recycling, but this is not a significant determinant. So again, we might have observed offsetting influences, as I spoke about earlier. Much of the literature controls for the percentage of the elderly living in a locality. I did that, result not significant. Tourists suppress recycling. Vote. So the more pro-government the locality is, the higher the uptake. Significant and strong. So this is, if you want to put it in a nutshell, this is the one variable which really has an impact on uptake. The time trend is positive, so on the net. And then there's a constant. Now I'll talk about the red one in a moment, but what does this tell us? This tells us that if you want to have a winner of a locality, then you would want a locality in which there's a lot of promotion, in which there's frequency of collection. Obviously, wouldn't want holidays to coincide with your collection dates, if possible. you'd want the locality to be well off, not poor. You'd want it to be ample in space, so with large houses, not everybody crammed. You'd want it to be not touristic, but fairly homogeneous. You'd want it to be pro-government, and you'd want it to be later on in time. So the best case scenarios from this data are those localities in those weeks which fulfill all of this. In truth, localities are a mixed bag. They score high on some and low on some others. And so what you actually observe is a mixture of all these phenomena, but my attempt was to parse them out. So I was very curious that the vote, of course, in a sense, I was satisfied that this came out as a significant variable. That's what you look for. But I was also curious to explore it a little further. What's going on? So one thing I did was to interact vote with PR. That is to say, I looked at what happens if we combine the force of voting and having a lot of promotion from the locality. And what happens is really interesting, is that becomes a really significant variable. So when you multiply an active local council with a pro-government locality, then you've got a very strong effect. Interestingly, what then happens to the PR variable is that when you have PR in a non-cooperative society or in a locality which doesn't like government, to put it in lay terms, that PR has a negative effect. So PRing something, or tentatively, or maybe this is a bit of a leak now, PRing something as a government thing is great if they like government, not so great if they don't. Okay, now, of course, we've got problems because this is a regional analysis. I haven't asked households anything. I've just observed regional data. There could be contamination of data. You know, you could say it was collected in Slema, but it had some of Gzira's waste in it. It's household, but it has some commercial. So, you know, it's not perfect data. There's a lot of reliance on dummy variables. Some variables could be endogenous, an estimation problem, whatever. I did tests that needed to be done for random effects, multicollinearity, calculated robust standard errors, and ran various specifications to test. But in conclusion, and I'm deliberately finishing early because I want to go into the next research, okay? What we have here is a rich panel data set, spatial and temporal, low levels of aggregation. We are observing actual recycling. We're not asking people to own up to how much they recycle or don't. This is actual streams of recycling with no influence of the surveyor and no distortion between what people report and what they actually do. Okay? So that's a positive. We've managed to document, and this is where my supervisors were invaluable to this study, because when you're a student doing your research, there's a lot of stuff which is interesting. But when you have the benefit of looking at something from a bit of a distance, then you can spot what's unique about the research. And what we've managed to document here is a situation where, despite a disincentive, people still recycled. This is quite original. What we normally have is people recycling because of an incentive to recycle, or at best, people recycling despite an incentive. But here, we actually had a disincentive. You would argue, but you know, garbage bags cost more or less the same price as recycling bags. Yes, but for the first 58 weeks, garbage bags were actually priced zero, because plastic bags at that time were given for free in retail, in the retail sector. I also controlled for the fact that garbage bags started to be necessary after 58 weeks, which means that that disincentive was wiped out because garbage bags cost more or less 8 cents. It had no effect, okay, by that time. So there seems to be an important variable here which has not been looked at a lot, in fact, almost at all, in environmental applications, and that is pro-government sentiment. If people feel good about government, they recycle. Why is this? Is it because of an ideology? Is it because at the time when I did this study, the government, the party in government was the Nationalist Party, and the localities which recycled more, holding everything else constant, were the Nationalist localities? Is it some kind of ideology? Is it that to be nationalist, you believe more in recycling? I can't answer that from this data. Is it out of loyalty? Is it because it's my government, so I will recycle for my government? Or disloyalty? It's not my government, I'm not going to recycle. Again, I can't answer this from this data. Because just because there's a vote, it could, you know, be capturing all of these phenomena. Is it a question of efficacy belief? I voted for this government, I trust this government, I therefore believe more that this government can do things with my recycled waste. Again, I can't answer this from this data. Which is why I wanted to leave space for the next studies, because it's exactly that which I will try to assess. So the next part of the research will be based on a survey experiment. The first part of the survey, or part of the survey, will look at the political determinants of recycling. Do political loyalties or government efficacy as perceived matter for uptake? Will a change in government make a difference to recycling intent? Will we now observe that some localities, certainly we do not expect localities that previously recycled well to stop recycling because there's a change in government. We don't expect that because habit will have set in, and that's a major force. But can we anticipate that those localities which maybe were reluctant to recycle under the previous government might now find a new motive to recycle? We know that there's an anomaly that people paid more to recycle, so will reversing this anomaly and making people pay more to remove garbage make a difference? If we proposed a pay-as-you-throw fee, how would people's intent to recycle vary? And would it make a difference what we called it? If we called it a tax, or if we didn't call it a tax? Again, tapping a political sentiment. Are people recycling well? And so do I have some kind of foolish goodwill in the sense that people feel they're recycling, but actually they're throwing the wrong thing in the garbage bag? This is again a problem with the data that I have, not being able to tell me this. Might people be confused into thinking that the scheme was compulsory? And therefore I didn't observe voluntary behavior at all. Maybe what I observed was a bunch of people thinking that this is compulsory because they believe in government and they believe that what's being rolled out is compulsory. These are all speculations at this point, nothing that the data can tell me on a regional basis, but certainly something that I could get from a good survey. And a lot of other questions besides. Like, for example, one key question is it a few households recycling a lot? Or is it all households recycling a little? I can't tell that from my regional data. So really what this study did is just open a hell of a lot of other questions that the next study will try to address. So just to focus a little bit, because of the title of this talk, on the political study that the survey will enable. Compared to other determinants, political interest has been widely neglected in the environmental literature. All sorts of motives have been studied: normative, environmental morality, having children, love of future generations, politics, understudied. So the first study will attempt to parse out whether there is this thing of, it's my government, I will contribute, okay? I'm going to say this in Maltese because it might have more resonance when I say it this way. Jistajkun hawn nies li ma jridux jgħinu biex ma jpaxxux il-gvern. Okay? It's a harsh way of saying it, but that's the phenomenon which I want to explore. Am I alone in wanting to study this phenomenon? This was my first concern. Has anybody else done this, or am I out on a complete limb here? There is some literature that controls for political orientation. In other words, there has been some suspicion that orientation politically could affect the result. But the results are mixed. So when people control for the way that people vote, they find mixed results. But there's a hell of a lot of literature that finds that socialists or left-leaning, left-wingers, love the environment more. They want to pay more for it, they express higher environmental attitude, they want more government intervention, they're more volunteers, and so forth. So left-leaning gives more. The question was, you know, is this just for the North? Not for the South. Well, Bateman has just written an excellent, thank God, paper which reviews political orientation and environmental giving, and it seems to be quite a systematic finding that people who are left-leaning have a greater social orientation environmentally. Of course, this is completely the opposite of what I found, because in my study, it was the right-leaning which were recycling more. For my future study, what's of interest to me is not left-right leaning, although I will control for that in as much as I can, but more a question of loyalty. As I did more research in this field, I realized that there's a whole field, of course, about political loyalty. It's called political identification or psychological attachment to the party. So I learned that there are constructs which measure this, that it's actually measured by Eurobarometer, European Social Value Survey, European Value Survey, and others. And so I had a construct which is credible to use in my survey. And I also found some literature which suggests that in complex environmental issues, like climate change, people may not bother to go into the scientific pros and cons of doing it, but rather use a rule of thumb. That rule of thumb will be some expert they believe. Someone they believe in Malta could credibly be the politician of their choice. And so if your politician, your minister for the environment, or your prime minister, or whoever, is saying, do this, that's good enough and better than going into the pros and cons of recycling. So my hypothesis is that voluntary participation is driven, holding everything else constant. So we're going to control for all those other things that people found relevant by an attempt to fulfill a moral motive. But that moral motive is not just love of the environment or future generations or all the things that we normally consider, but also love of your party. A kind of desire to contribute to your party. Now, how unreasonable is this? Witness what happened in the last election. People were coughing up money for the party of their choice. Money, not just time, effort, money. People volunteer to the party. Why shouldn't this be a phenomenon? In fact, the more I think about it, the more I think, it must be a phenomenon. You're doing something in the public sphere. If you like the public sector or who's leading it, it's got to be a force that pushes you to. But of course, my null hypothesis must be that it isn't, so that we can then find out whether it is. So the methodology will be a dedicated survey experiment using, we're going to generate household, a random household sample. So first we cluster all people in Malta into the household in which they belong using the electoral register, and then we draw one in every thousand of those, or one in every so many of those households. So we have it's a purposive random sample, basically. Then we're going to call them up. We're going to trace their numbers and call them up. And nothing of their identity will be given to the surveyors. So surveyors are calling up in the dark, basically. What are they going to ask them? They're going to ask them about the type of dwelling they live in. As we know, space makes a difference. So if they have a garden, a yard, whatever, and how long they've been living there. Because the longer they've been living there, the more they're going to care about their neighbors and so social pressures. We're going to ask them how they perceive the scheme attributes. And this is another defect of my first study. In the first study, I looked at actual scheme attributes. What do those matter if people don't perceive them to be that way? So what really matters is how people perceive. How often waste is collected, what they can put in the garbage bag, and so on and so forth, because that's what they're going to act towards. So we're already finding, because we've started the survey, that there's a lot of error in their perception of what you should put in the bag, for example. So we may have observed recyclers, but we observed actually mistaken recyclers, unfortunately. Then a barrage of questions about how they recycle. How often, what type, how intensely they recycle, how much of their fractions they sort, how long they've been recycling, and so forth. And then we're going to ask them about their other environmental behaviors, just to see whether recycling is a good litmus test of the environmentalist or not. So about hunting, about the tree for you, planting, tree planting, another issue which was heavily publicized, even by central government, so could have had the same effect. And also whether they have solar panels and all the you know, basic environmental behavior that we can observe. Then there's questions about their attitude, so that we can control for their moral inclination. Then there's all the constructs related to politics, how they vote, party identification, loyalty, trust, efficacy belief, you name it. Cross-voting to see, to have a gauge of whether they're really hardcore party liners or not, whether they pay a membership to any party. So I assure you that this is the first survey that has had so much environment and recycling and so much politics in it. And this is where you start to hopefully make a contribution. Needless to say, it's a leap in the dark, because we could find that none of this actually matters. But then, hey, someone would have explored it. And then the survey randomizes some scenarios. So some people are exposed to one scenario, some people are exposed to another scenario, just to see if that will create a difference in intent. Okay? Some people get a pay-as-you-throw tax, some people get a high one, some people get a low one, some people are reminded that we have a new government, some people are not, and we see if that will affect intent to recycle. Okay, there's four scenarios, basically. There's personal data, everything you can imagine to be relevant in demographics, and there's a gratitude construct, because we're doing some research in the center, in where I'm doing the PhD, which suggests that people who are grateful tend to give more to the environment. So this is another hypothesis unrelated to what I've spoken about. Last slide. There's been a pilot study done amongst 110 people. It was a pen and paper, and it covered all of this. I did it amongst a group which were very religious, so they were basically doing some voluntary work for the church, with a high average age, a high average income, and high education. So almost the best case scenario, established households, couples who are, you know, very steady and stable, volunteers, the pillars of society, basically. So what did I find? Well, they have a 72% recycling rate, which is like, this would be the oasis we're trying to reach as Malta. If everybody were like these people, we'd have no problem at all. They do what they're supposed to. They even compost, a lot of them. when presented with a tax, their intent to recycle rises, okay, in the hypothetical scenarios. They, you know, take out their garbage four times a week. They separate 1.2 times a week, so between 1 and 2 times a week, take out their gray bag, that is. And yet they don't know 4 out of 7 of the scheme attributes. So how often, what's the price, you know, they're doing this even without complete clarity of how the scheme operates. 41% incorrectly believe that the scheme is mandatory. So there goes my paper one, thinking everybody's doing voluntary. In fact, it's a mixed bag. Some of them actually think this is a law. Now, I don't know if this has something to do with the average age, or if this has something to do with I can't be stupid enough to be recycling and paying for it. I don't know what, or maybe they suddenly were faced with the doubt when I asked them the question. We're replicating this in the larger survey. Certainly, it gives some indication of the role of belief management when you roll out a voluntary scheme. So if you roll out a voluntary scheme and don't emphasize that it's voluntary, people might do it because they think it's mandatory, and you save on a lot of enforcement costs. That's an interesting finding in itself. There's evidence of what we call corner solutions. So people either recycle the whole thing or they don't. There are people who do halfway house, but generally speaking, when you get into the habit, it starts to become a tipping point that it's better to do the whole thing rather than occasionally think whether to do it or not. So you just go into automatic mode. As interestingly, because these were couples, so I could actually split the couple. In fact, it was very sweet because I had all the men on one side and all the women on one side. And I asked them, do you think your partner does it as good as you do? And 72% think that they're, you know, not an exception, basically. And in fact, the results show that whether you ask the man or the woman, the report is roughly the same. The housekeeper tends to know more about the attributes of the scheme, but the behavior tends to be the same. Amongst the motives they gave, they feel a moral duty, they want to reduce wastefulness, they feel it's good for the environment. They feel that their recycling is effective, so efficacy belief is a major, major determinant in recycling. I recall having a conversation with a politician, actually, who had said at one point in public something like, it's a shame that more households don't recycle. And I said, that's the worst thing you could say. You know, you need to constantly emphasize that households are actually recycling, because you're going to give a reverse normative effect by saying that, emphasizing that households don't. 56% use government or local councils as their information sources, so the private sector wasn't one thing that was mentioned. Interestingly, amongst this very, very high recycling cohort or group, which is a skewed sample, okay, this was just a pilot, 75% vote pro-government. That tells us nothing. It doesn't tell us that the ones who don't recycle as much as they do. It just tells us that there is, you know, here is a skewed sample of pro-government voters who, by the way, happen to recycle a lot. But they also happen to be volunteers, the pillars of society, because they're, you know, they're established families and so on and so forth. 45% also declared that they feel a loyalty to their party. So this was at the early stages of the pilot, before we got hold of the actual right question to ask, and it was a very simple question. Do you feel loyal to your party? And the gradation of how loyal they felt. As you can see, it's a work in progress, flagging as many questions as it does answers. That's basically my story, and I'm very happy to listen to any comments or criticisms or suggestions, and I'm armed with a notebook to make sure that I'll take note of everything.
Yeah. Initially you said the highly educated in the beginning would tend to recycle more, right? But then when you had the graduates on, it was the opposite field. Can you explain that? Because
okay.
I didn't quite...
So this was something that I had to, be very careful how I articulated, because the literature tells you two things about education. It tells you that it's positive in that it tends to be associated with higher environmental awareness and therefore higher recycling. On the other hand, when you've got graduates whose time cost is higher, so spending time recycling comes at a higher cost if you've got a graduate job than if you're at home without a job, basically. And so people whose time cost is higher, the opportunity cost of time, basically, may have a lower motive to, quote-unquote, waste time recycling. Now, I used graduates to explore cost of time. In effect, the result of having more graduates in a locality was not significant on recycling, and possibly one reason could be that there are two phenomena which this variable captures, and they work against each other.
What about the last one when you had the hundreds, the last survey that you did,
no,
with the highly educated? I mean, what kind of...
There was, I didn't test the relationship between any variables and recycling because the sample size was too small and because the extent of uptake of recycling was almost homogeneous. These were high recyclers. So what the pilot allowed me to do was to test how clear are the questions, you know, will there be a variation in the answer and so forth.
This is more a question with respect to the variables chosen, because this is my thinking, what I would have assumed, just pure assumption based, not based on much literature, but on some awareness of environmental politics, is this community effect of if you're aware in your community that there are people recycling, you might want to follow that example. I don't know.
Okay, so one of the shortcomings of the study is that it has a very, very poor proxy to gauge social influence. Okay, so there's just the only proxy that there is for social influence is how similar are the people, how much tourism is there in this locality, and that's not a great proxy. A much better proxy would have been something that captures, or a much better variable would have been something that captures the dynamics. So some kind of lagged variable, which, you know, the more they did last week, the more they'll do this week. And of course, if you put a lagged variable in this function, it's explosive. It's kind of what happened last week almost fully explains what will happen this week. But even then, you can't tell whether that's social influence. So I also could have considered to gauge the extent to which people think that they're... Remember, I only have aggregate data. And we're blessed that this aggregate data was collected in the first place. I mean, the fact that there was from each... let's put it this way. MEPA, WasteServe, local councils could have just not calculated on a locality level and totaled up the amount of recycling every week going into the recycling plant. By some fluke, or for some academic reason, this data was kept at a regional level. That's lucky. That enables this kind of study. But it doesn't enable us to gauge to what extent does the individual think that the other households are recycling. For that, we'll go to the survey.
You touch on it briefly when you look at the conclusion of your first study in terms of what if the quality of this recycling is actually poor? They believe they're doing something. Is there actually data, maybe from WasteServe, about the quality when you receive the bags? Is it all good recycling, that kind of?
Yes, they did carry an analysis even to determine the, to work it out with these schemes. So there is an estimation of how much is unlikely to go as refuse-derived fuels rather than to actually be recycled. So there is that kind of information as well, which has been carried out.
We do know, even from published studies, from NSO, waste survey, etc., that of course recycling is not perfectly conducted. I mean, even anecdotally, if you walk in the streets, and believe me, you will do after listening to a presentation like this, you and working in waste and thinking about waste, you tend to develop this habit of looking at the grey bags and seeing what there's inside it. And you will notice that there's stuff which shouldn't be there, like glass, like certain packets and so forth. But it doesn't take away anything from the fact that people are contributing. Now, they may be doing it with some noise, some error, but the fact that it's happening is the phenomenon of interest. What's interesting here is that people are taking time, taking space, paying for bags, cooperating with no incentive. That is the interesting phenomenon. That they're doing it incorrectly, sloppily, okay, creates a bit of noise, but that they're doing it is what's interesting. And what I'm interested to study is, should we have policy which is aimed at people who want to be good?
Yes, that's part of my question, Murray. First of all, thank you for an extremely lucid and enjoyable presentation and for the incredibly wide-ranging nature of the presentation. You begin with a very general theoretical approach, which is important, which is to consider the radically two alternatives, which are homo economicus, the rational, formally rational man in the sense used in neoclassical economics and in Weberian sociology. This is a guy who maximizes his self-interest by careful calculation. And you're concerned with that issue vis-a-vis the other possibility, which you report from other studies, that in fact people are surprisingly altruistic and they do things for the community even if it has an individual disincentive effect. I like the incredible number of variables. The incredible number of variables you're aware of, and that you're trying to consider. And I think the fact that you have done a big pre-study, that you have a lot of data from the National Statistics Office, and you've taken it as far as you can. I think this sets a very good context for the further study you have in mind. My problem is not so much that there's a poor proxy for social influence. My problem is that I don't see a good proxy here or a useful proxy here for the moral motivation you're interested in. I mean, I think it's very interesting that using graduate as a proxy for pay disincentive, for money stroke time disincentive, that's nice as far as critiquing or querying homo economicus is concerned. But in both the all the work you've done in the big preliminary study, and also in the variables you're trying to outline for your next study, and certainly for your pilot scheme, and may I say, I think 110 is quite a large number to really adequately study 110 people ain't easy. But where's the moral variable here, Amari? Where is the altruism variable that you're going to consider when you do your study? How are you going to frame that?
Okay, so let me take that question head on. In the next study, there is a big section which is dedicated to understand people's attitudes, and then that is really parsed out between how they feel towards the environment, how they feel towards their responsibility as a household vis-a-vis the rest of what can be done for them, how they feel towards the future, how they feel about the economy, how they feel about waste in general, wastefulness, whether they believe that what they do, so, you know, there's all the underlying things which could affect your moral motive, efficacy belief, awareness, a sense of responsibility. All of those, there's different statements. Another way to answer that question is that I have a very blunt question. Do you consider yourself an environmentalist? boom. And because in Maltese, environmentalists tends to have very radical, I also asked them, do you consider yourself to be pro-environment? So, and then I have the behavioral variables, that is to say, can I gauge a person's morality by what they do in other realms of the environment? So that's all intended to gauge whether there is an environmental morality, which of course needs to be controlled for if I want to identify a political morality. Otherwise, the political morality might be capturing all of the other stuff too. So yes, clearly morality, moral motive, is not going to be precisely captured in a study which uses regional data. I'm just observing trends, you know. I wished in the beginning, I was, you know, secretly hoping that I would find a variable which captures morality. The closest I could get to that was how they vote.
No, I'm not questioning the study that you did.
Yeah.
I hadn't picked up in the study you're intending that you had so much so many questions you were going to ask.
There's a lot on attitude. There's about 21 questions on attitude. And there's the gratitude construct, which I think merits a bit of time because it's novel. The idea that people who score high on this, it's called the gratitude construct 6, basically 6 questions. The idea that people who score high on gratitude also are bigger altruists is a new field of study. And this also starts to hack at this morality thing. Do people who find themselves being grateful to life in general, to their life's experiences, does this describe the type of person? Note, I'm not saying that if you're grateful, you recycle more. I'm saying if you have this trait, gratitude, might you be the type of person to also be more altruistic? That's the question that explores.
Well, certainly social anthropologists, and I'm in particular, I'm an economic anthropologist, would in fact expect, you know, a high correlation between whatever your social attitude is and whether your recycling behavior is positive or negative. But what, as you know, social anthropology has been up to for about the last 25 or 30 years is a concern with discourse, concern with the way people talk about themselves, their society, other people. And I think this may be useful for you because the actual discourses they come up with, however brief, are a clue which you might need to decipher. I mean, you need to find out the way they talk about loyalties, the way in Maltese, in their locality. They may not immediately start giving you stuff about either A, their concern about the environment, or B, their sense of duty. Words like duty, responsabilità, you know, ambient might not crop up in their discourse. But I think you perhaps need, you know, the good old free bit at the end, where the questioners are prompted to ask them for their views as to why they do this, why it is important. Perhaps the word moral is not preempting them too much if you ask them that. But I think the discourse, the words you use in your questionnaire, are going to turn out to be crucial. And what any anthropologist would tell you is, you should leave space for them to come up with their words, i.e. their discourse, or else, in a sense, you're skewing the entire sample in terms of your definition of gratitude, of duty, of environment.
I fully agree. There are two places in the survey where there's freedom to express. One at the very end, which is, you know, now we've done it, now express. Two, at the place where I ask non-recyclers, why not? Say anything you want, you know, say anything you want. But I do take your point that a little bit more elbow room for them to use their own words would be a great idea. And also, something which has come up in discussion, the possibility of doing some qualitative work. Now, the reason why I didn't do that, apart from the fact that this is an economics degree, one reason why I didn't go there is because there's so much literature and so much groundwork been done. So it almost was, do I need to reinvent the wheel here? But as it happens that we are inventing possibly a wheel, maybe it does merit, you know, going down that route. And I think this will be one of the next studies to be done.
Certainly for economic anthropologists who are very, very into the whole debate between between formal profit utility maximizing rationalities and other rationalities, where the very notion of reason is that you're not maximizing self-interest, but you're maximizing some social goal to which your community adheres. I think this is such an interesting debate.
Yes.
That if you could explore the debate with which you opened up your paper this evening, you know, a bit more, it would be very, very interesting for social anthropology.
Exactly. No, I agree. And definitely, I mean, no matter how well you frame the survey so as to enable all the possible nuances, you're still framing the survey. So, you know, that's absolutely true. One thing I will say is that there's a very interesting recent paper which basically explores different frames for recycling,
different
framing of recycling, of the recycling argument, and tests whether people of different political ideologies like that framing more, and concludes that there are certain frames which appeal much more broadly than certain others, talking about waste or wastefulness in Malta might appeal more than, for example, talking about future generations. Talking about everybody does it might appeal more than talking about it's more convenient. Whatever it is that appeals, but we'll know this from this survey because we'll see different levels of agreement with the different statements, albeit it's us putting those statements before them.
I do take your point that even party loyalty or pro-government voting could be, in fact, one indication of altruism. It's mean thinking beyond yourself. You know, it's thinking beyond a purely individual calculus is part of what you aim to somehow measure in this study. It's not your only aim, but it is, I think, an important aim.
Exactly.
It really ties you up with a world literature, and it's just such an important question. It also ties up with critiques of neoliberalism, and the extent to which if you allow people to follow their individual self-interest, you end up with a higher degree of welfare throughout the society or not. So I think it's a very important question. But you could also explore perhaps other statements indices you could make. Even when people do something because other people are doing it, the imitation effect, that can be at least a sign of social sensitivity.
Absolutely.
It's not altruism in the strict technical sense of the word. But if people are doing it because other people in the neighborhood are doing it, that arguably contains a community effect, which is better than the purely isolated individual only thinking of himself, if you know what I mean.
Yes. I mean, we the term impure altruism is exactly that, you know. It's altruism, but it's impure. It's altruism with a touch of self-interest. You're doing something altruistic, but you're getting something back for it. A warm glow. A feeling of belonging. Of course, pure altruism would be where you stop doing something if your effort is not needed. But impure altruists will continue to give because they feel so good giving. And that's, you know, most people feel good to give.
That's why for me, the whole issue of altruism, as you expressed at the beginning of your paper, is in a sense more interesting than the issue of pure environmentalism as such. And so I would suggest that you come up with as many ways in which social socially oriented behavior as opposed to individually maximizing behavior could be broken down, you know, along the lines you've mentioned. Because these might give you further insights if, by chance, you found out there was a high correlation. The way you break down this altruism into sub-questions and sub-terms may also be helpful. There is one question that I really have to ask here. It's about the whole original thrust of your study. Sometimes in Mozart, you don't know whether to laugh or to cry. It seems so counterintuitive that party membership should be correlated so positively with recycling. You know, it seems so utterly, how do I want to put this? It seems so utterly irrelevant to the actual business of recycling and even the environmental effect of recycling. But I can't see that it has been under-researched. It's very under-researched, and therefore this could be a fascinating way in which to go. The idea, but I think Malta is unique, the idea that party loyalty of all things should be closely correlated in some sense a cause of whether or not people, you know, it's fascinating. Right? That just is fascinating. And if you can find, that's why I want you to subdivide your, if I may put it that way, your social orientation a bit more than you've got there, so that we can also find out whether it is indeed party loyalty. Because at the moment, the problem, obviously, as you yourself realize with your existing research, is that you can't use pro-government voting as a proxy for pro-environment or social altruism or any kind of social orientation. It's just all you had, given the data in this NSO. I do understand that, but when you're going to do your second research, I think that that's another reason why I would break down your social orientation, just to be sure that in isolating this pro-government factor, you are indeed isolating the fact.
Yes.
Because if you do find out that pro-government feeling is involved, I must say that is very surprising. For me, very interesting, extremely interesting.
I'll say this. I had two major moments in this research. The first is what actually started me studying in the first place, which is when I observed people actually buying those grey bags. That for me was a moment of everything I've learned makes no sense anymore. I have learned that you have to give incentives to people, not disincentives, if you want them to do something. And the environmental economics that I'd learned and been teaching and advocating for so long suddenly crumbled, you know. And that's when I started looking at behavioral economics, which had, in the meantime, evolved and started to explore these counterintuitive situations where people were driven by something else other than self-interest. So that was my first moment of goodness. The second moment was when I thought, wait a minute. If you don't believe in government, if you don't like government, if you don't like the public sector or who's driving it, why should you contribute? You know, at the very least, it must suppress something in you. When you're at that moment looking with a dirty can of tuna in your hand at the option of just throwing it in the bin, which is going to go away tomorrow, and you're never going to bother with it again, or rinsing it out, washing it, and then putting it in your storage and whatever. And you're thinking, and of course you don't do this with every single item you throw away, but sometimes you do pause to think, is it worth it? What goes through your mind at that moment? I'm the type of person to recycle. I'm a moral person. It's bad for the environment, future generations. Oh, but they might mix the whole thing up again when they collect it, or do they know what they're doing with the recycling? Or anyway, other households don't recycle. All those things. And what might go through your head if you're loyal not to the party in government but to the party in opposition is, why should I bother to help government? And it's not so, you know, completely out of this world to think that.
The question is, how has the change of government, how might this affect your study?
Okay, so now this is interesting because, of course, so many things have changed in the meantime. People have learned to recycle, there's more example of recycling. policy has gotten better. We've gotten better at making, helping people to recycle. And now we have a change in government. So could some, you know, reluctant non-recyclers, could there be a subgroup of those recyclers whose tipping point into recycling could be this change in government? Maybe not. If we don't observe a change, it doesn't mean that this phenomenon doesn't exist. It just means that there's so many other phenomena going on that we can't isolate it. On the other hand, one thing that I'm trying to do is to see, since when did you start recycling? Do you intend to recycle? Is there higher intent to recycle amongst non-recyclers who are loyal to the new government? So that's even without comparing to any other constructs. It's just asking, just looking at a difference in difference. You know, there's going to be a difference. I'll admit that in a field like behavior, there's so many phenomena going on. You know, it's almost ambitious to try and parse out any drivers of behavior, still less something that hasn't been explored. So we might find a zero effect. Once we've controlled for all the things that are going on, we might find that there's nothing there and it was a leap in the dark which crash-landed in the valley, you know. But as long as we do it as well as we can and maybe open an agenda for exploration, then that's good enough, hopefully.
What I'm concerned about is that if you're saying that before the last election, pro-government people recycled more, now that they are in opposition, so to speak, will that detract from that loyalty that they had before and recycle less?
I would hazard to say that it's unlikely to happen, because one of the strongest forces in recycling is habit. So once you've set up to do it, you don't unset up. It's too much effort to then not set up. In fact, most recyclers will have found a system that actually now makes it more convenient to recycle. So on the margin, you know, you might say, damn this can of tuna, I'm going to throw it away. You know, I'm going to rebel against government and throw my dirty tuna can in the rubbish. But I wouldn't expect to observe a reversal. But maybe a reinforcing of reluctance. In other words, I don't think that the effect is symmetrical in the negative, in reversal.
Let me just follow up that one question. What happens if Leo Brinkat, or, you know, Labour Party environmental ministers, what if they do start pushing, they start doing recycling, as it were, they start campaigning for recycling? How then are you going to measure? I'm sure you've thought about this. You've had a nationalist government which instituted the scheme in the first place. Now, as the person is just questioning, then what happens if the new government does the same thing? How then are you going to handle? I'm sure you've thought of this. How are you going to handle this as a variable?
Yes. It's almost taken as read that this is what will happen. So it's very unlikely that, you know, there won't be some kind of politicization of the process or some kind of political communication. And in a sense, that's just going to be a continuity, but for a different group. What's more interesting, I think, and taking from your question, is what does this say to politicians about what kind of things they should front? So on the one hand, having a politician fronting a social intervention or an environmental intervention is great, because it's a good shortcut for those people who believe in that politician to do what that politician is telling them. On the other hand, it could be a surefire way of alienating half the population instantly. So one thing that you could take away from this is that if you're going to have an environmental initiative, have a less divisive figure than a politician fronting it. Because people will look to experts or peers or people they believe in to take the shortcut as to what they should do. Environmental arguments are complex, you know. Climate change, recycling, landfills, there's all sorts of technical terms. And if somebody I believe tells me I should do it, you know, that saves me thinking. But when you've got a politician in Malta, no matter how good that politician is, it is, unfortunately, almost by definition, a divisive figure. I guess one interesting result is that politicians should not front the very campaigns they believe in.
Well, what would be clearly interesting, actually, now that you have preliminary data which shows a relatively high correlation between voting for the government in the past election and recycling, if you now find that it switches, if you now find that indeed, with first of all, as part of your research, you've got to get the government minister to take part in your research by coming up with a very strong statement. Get him to come up with a very strong statement, which, as you said, very possibly he will, in favor of recycling. Then see what your results show. Connect them with the next, it could be a local council election, it could be the EU parliamentary the MEP elections, and then see if there is a complete switch in the nature of the people who recycle. That, of course, would prove that you would come up with something very unusual.
Reversal is not expected, but uptake by non-recyclers could be what proves it. What I also think is that moving away from recycling and going into other fields to see the influence of a political statement on behavior. Malta is such a good place to do this kind of study because we've got a 50-50 divide, quite strong emotions, you know, we complain about the political situation in Malta, but hey, let's just use it to make interesting studies. It's, you know, it's a laboratory for this kind of study. You couldn't get better.
Mari, thank you so much for such a lucid presentation. This is fascinating research. We wish you well. This is, in fact, as a little piece of information for your research, this is, I think, the very first, what you might say, it is the first seminar we've had on recycling. We've had Mark Falzone speak on the hunting lobby in a very interesting way, but this is the first we've had on recycling, in which, since we've been going for 16 years, I don't claim this seminar series is a proper gauge of the kind of social research which is going on in the university community, but it is intriguing that you are the first. So thank you so much, and we wish you well, and we want to see you back next year with discussion of some of the results. Thank you very much.
You have just listened to a talk in the Work in Progress seminar series entitled Rubbish Politics, Political Motivation and the Reluctance to Recycle in Maltese Environmental Behavior. This talk was delivered by Ms. Mari Briguglia.